June 1st, 1962, Lecture 52, Symmetry in Physical Laws. June 1st, 1962, Lecture 52, Symmetry in Physical Laws. June 1st, 1962, Lecture 52, Symmetry in Physical Laws.
Subjects that I had wanted to talk about, but felt that that would be more proper in some other part of the place in the course, but perhaps I wouldn't have enough time at the end, so I didn't do it. Now I have one more lecture here at the end with nothing to do, and so I'm taking one of the lectures that should probably be a little earlier, and so it isn't relevant to the last thing we said. It's relevant to something earlier. But nevertheless, I've chosen this particular one of my little collection of four or five goodies to use as the last one. And this subject that I would talk about today is this question of symmetry in physical laws. We've already said quite a bit about symmetry in the physical laws when we're discussing vector analysis. And I'll just remind you of some of the points. In the first place, that symmetry is always fascinating to the human mind. Everyone likes to symmetrical things in some way. But the problem of defining symmetry is an interesting one, and we already noted that Weyl gave a good definition. A thing is symmetrical if there's something you can do to it so that after you've done it, it looks the same as it did before. For example, a symmetrical vase is of such a kind that if you reflect it or if you turn it, it'll look the same as it did before. And no, we use that idea, that definition, that abstract definition in physics to mean the subject then of our discourse today is what we can do to the physical phenomenon or the physical situation in an experiment and yet leave the result the same. I give a number of illustrations. We've already had some of them. The first will be, for example, translation in space. If we do an experiment in a certain region, and then build another apparatus in another place in space, or move the original one over here, then whatever went on in the one apparatus in a certain order in time, click-clack, so on, if you've arranged the other one in the same condition, it'll behave in the same way, with all the restrictions that we mentioned before, that all of those features of the environment which make it not behave the same way is also moved over, and we talked about the problem of defining how much we should include under those circumstances, but I won't go into those details again. In the same way, we believe today also that a displacement in time will have no effect on our physical laws. That is, as far as we know today. All these things are as far as we know today. That means that if we build a certain apparatus and start it on a certain time on Thursday at 10 a.m., and then build the same apparatus and start it, say, 3 days later in the same condition, that the behaviors as a function of time will occupy the same times and go through the same motions in exactly the same way, no matter what the time was. Provided, of course, again, that the relevant features of the environment are also modified in time appropriately. That does means, of course, that if you bought General Motors 3 months ago, the same thing would happen as if you buy it now. Now, so we have to watch out for geographical differences. There are, of course, variations in the characteristics of the Earth's surface, so that, for example, if you measure the magnetic field in a certain region and move the apparatus to some other region, it will not work the same way because the magnetic field is different, but we say that that's associated with the Earth, and then we then imagine that if we move the whole Earth and the equipment that it would make no difference. Another thing that we discussed in considerable detail was rotations in space, that if you turn an apparatus at an angle, it works just as well, provided you turn everything else along with it that's relevant. And this was the basis of vector analysis. In fact, that's where we discussed the situation in most detail, with the problem of rotation and symmetry under rotation in space. And we invented a mathematical system called vector analysis to handle as neatly as possible. On a more advanced level, we had another symmetry, which was the symmetry under uniform velocity in a straight line. That is to say, a rather remarkable effect, that if you have a piece of apparatus working in a certain way, then you take the same apparatus and put it in a car or something and move the whole car, plus all the relevant materials and so on, at a uniform velocity in a straight line, then as far as the phenomena inside the car are concerned, there's no apparent difference, that all the laws of physics appear the same. And we even know more technically how to express that, and that is that the mathematical equations of the physical laws must be unchanged under a Lorentz transformation. As a matter of fact, it was the study of the relativity problem which concentrated physicists' attention most sharply on the problem of symmetry and physical laws. That was when we first kind of woke up to the interest in this problem. Now, there are other symmetries, for example, of a different kind. These have so far been geometrical, sort of, time and space being more or less the same. And there are others. For example, there's a symmetry which goes this way, that you can replace one atom for another of the same kind. It sounds like a hedge. But to put it a different way, there are atoms of the same kind. It is possible to find the groups of atoms, so if you change a pair around, it doesn't make any difference. The atoms are identical, and whatever one atom of oxygen of a certain type will do, another atom of oxygen of that type will do. You say, that's ridiculous. That's the definition of equal type. It's not maybe the definition, but then the fact is that there are many, many atoms of the same type. It may be a definition, but we still don't know whether there are any atoms of the same type, but the fact is that there are many atoms of the same type, and then it does mean something to say that it makes no difference if we replace one atom by another of the same type. Now, there are, after this long list of things that can be done without changing the phenomena, you'd think that practically you can do anything. So I give some examples of the contrary, just to see the difference. Suppose that we ask, are the physical laws symmetrical for change of scale? Suppose I built a certain piece of apparatus, and then I built another apparatus 5 times bigger in every part. Will it work exactly the same way? And the answer is, in this case, no. The wavelength of light emitted, for example, by one of the atoms inside the one box of sodium atoms, and the wavelength of light emitted by a gas of sodium atoms 5 times in volume is not 5 times longer, but is in fact exactly the same as the other, so that the ratio of the wavelength to the size of the emitter will change, and there will be other things that will change, and the physical phenomena will change. To consider another example, you've probably seen in the newspaper every once in a while a picture of a great cathedral made with little matchsticks, a tremendous work of art by some guy that's retired that keeps putting matchsticks in and gluing them together, and it's just much more elaborate and wonderful than any real cathedral. And you imagine that this thing were built on the scale of a real cathedral, you'll see where the trouble is. It wouldn't last. The whole thing would collapse because of the fact that the matchsticks are not strong enough. Yes, you say, but you told me that when there's an influence from the outside, it also must be changed in proportion. And we're talking about the withstanding of the object against gravitation. So what we should do is take the little cathedral of matchsticks and the real Earth, and then it's stable. And then take the larger cathedral and take a bigger Earth. Oh, it's even worse, you see, because the gravitation is therefore increased still more. The fact that things depend on the scale, we understand today, of course, on the grounds that things are atomic in nature, and that if we built an apparatus that was so small that there were only 5 atoms in it, it's something you can't scale up and down. But the first discovery that the laws of physics were not unchanged under a change of scale is interesting. It was made by Galileo. He realized that the strengths of materials were not in proportion to their sizes in exactly the right proportion, and illustrated this thing that I was talking about with the cathedral of matchsticks by drawing 2 bones, the bone of a dog that was in the right proportion for holding up his weight, and the imaginary bone of an animal that would be, say, 10 or 100 times bigger, and that's just a big solid thing with different proportions, and argued that the strength of beams is not in proportion, in the right proportion, and that the laws of nature have a definite scale. I don't know if he ever put it quite to the point that the laws of nature have a definite scale, but he was so impressed with this discovery that he considered it as probably as important as his discoveries of the laws of motion, because he published them both in the same volume called On Two New Sciences. So that's one. Now, another example of what we know well now is not one which is the laws are symmetrical, is this. A system in uniform rotation and a uniform angular velocity is not give the same apparent laws as one which is not rotating. If we put everything in a space, make an experiment and put everything in a spaceship and have the spaceship spinning in empty space all by itself, all alone, just spinning quietly at a constant angular velocity, nevertheless, the apparatus will not work the same way, because as you know, the things will be thrown to the outside, inside the equipment and so on by the centrifugal forces or Coriolis forces will affect it, etc. And in fact, we can tell that the Earth is rotating by Foucault pendulum without looking outside. So that's an effect of the uniform angular velocity. Next, I would like to mention a very interesting symmetry, which is prima facie, that I think means at first look, or something like that. Obviously false, that is reversibility in time. The physical laws apparently can't be irreversible, can't be reversible in time, because once said, never taken back, the moving finger writes and having writ business, ratchet and pawl, and so on. And we discussed that in considerable detail to discover that although all obvious phenomena are irreversible on a large scale, as far as we can tell, this irreversibility is nothing but due to the very large number of particles involved. And that if we could see the individual molecules, we would not be able to discern whether the machinery was working forwards or backwards. To make it more precise, build an apparatus in which you know what all the atoms are doing, small ones, so you can watch everything and see them jiggling. Now build another apparatus, but start it in the final condition of this one, with all the velocities reversed. Then the point is it'll go through the motions in reverse. Putting it another way, if we take a moving picture with sufficient detail of all the inner guts of a piece of material and shine it on a screen and run it backwards, no physicist will be able to say that's against the laws of physics, that's doing something wrong. If you don't see all the details, of course, he'd be perfectly clear. If you see the egg splattering on the sidewalk and the shell cracking open and so on, then you say that's irreversible, because if you take the moving picture backwards, the egg all collects, the shell goes back together, and it's ridiculous. But if you look at the atoms in themselves, the laws look reversible. This is, of course, a much harder discovery to have made, but apparently it is true that the fundamental physical laws on a microscopic and fundamental level are reversible in time. The symmetries of the physical laws are very interesting at this level, but they turn out in the end to be even more interesting and exciting when we come to quantum mechanics. For a reason which I cannot make clear at this level, in fact, that I still find somewhat staggering, but the most profound and beautiful thing is that in the quantum mechanics, for each of the rules of symmetry, there's a corresponding conservation law, and there's a definite connection between the laws of conservations and the symmetries of the physical laws. I only tell you this without any attempt at explanation. The fact, for example, that the laws are symmetrical for translation in space turns out, when you add the principles of quantum mechanics, that's a superposition of amplitude, to mean that momentum will be conserved. That the translation in time makes no difference, and quantum mechanics means that the energy is conserved. The rotation in space corresponds to the conservation of angular momentum. This is a very interesting and beautiful thing, probably the most beautiful and profound of things in physics, but I'm sorry that I can't explain it in any way to illustrate at all how it comes about. Incidentally, there are a number of symmetries which have no classical analog, which have no way to describe them in classical physics, that have directly to do with the quantum mechanics, and that I can illustrate one thing. If psi is the amplitude for something or other, the square of it, absolute square, is the probability of that something or other. Now, if someone else will make his calculations, not with a psi, but with a different psi, which differs merely by a change in phase. Let delta be some constant and multiply e to the I delta times the old psi. Then the absolute square of psi prime, which is the probability of any event, is equal to the absolute square of psi. And therefore, the physical laws are unchanged if the phase of the wave function is arbitrarily shifted. So there's another symmetry, which is a symmetry against shift in quantum mechanical phase. The nature laws must be of such a nature, the physical laws must be of such a nature that a shift in the quantum mechanical phase makes no difference. And like the principle that I just mentioned in quantum mechanics, for every symmetry, there's a conservation law. The conservation law, which is connected with the quantum mechanical phase, seems to be the conservation of electrical charge. A very interesting business altogether. Now, the next geometrical question, and the one which is going to concern us over most of the rest of this lecture, is a question of the discussion, the question of reflection in space. The problem is this. Are the physical laws symmetrical under reflection? Put it this way. Suppose I build a piece of equipment, let's say a clock, with lots of wheels and things and hands and numbers and everything, and it ticks and it works and it's got springs wound up inside. I look at the clock in a mirror. There's nothing about how it looks in the mirror. That's not the thing. The question is this. I build another clock, which is exactly the same as that clock looks in a mirror. Every time there's a screw with a right-hand thread in here, I put a screw with a left-hand thread in the corresponding plate. Where the thing is marked 2 on the face, I mark 2 backwards on the face over here. Each wheel, each coiled spring of the hair spring is twisted one way, twisted in the mirror image on the other way. So when I'm all finished, I have two things which have both physical, which bear to each other the relation of an object and its mirror image, although they are both objects, as I wish to emphasize, because it's a physical question, not a theoretical one alone. Now the physical question is, if the two things are started in the same condition, the springs are wound to the corresponding tightnesses and everything, whether the two clocks will tick and go around and look forever after as exact mirror images. I think your intuition about the laws of physics would suggest that they would. And so we would suspect that, at least in the case of these clocks, that reflection in space is one of the other symmetries of physical laws. That if I change from right to left, everything from right to left, and build otherwise the same, you cannot tell the difference. Let us then suppose for a while that this is true. If it's true, then it would be impossible to distinguish right and left by any physical phenomenon. Just as, for example, it's impossible to define a particular velocity by a physical phenomenon the moment it becomes true that the laws of physics don't depend on the absolute velocity. And so it's impossible by any physical phenomenon to define absolutely what you mean by right as opposed to left, because the world should be symmetrical, the physical law should be symmetrical. You see, the world doesn't have to be symmetrical. For example, by geography, surely right can be defined. For instance, I stand in New Orleans and look at Chicago, and Florida is to my right when the air is above my head, when my feet are on the ground. So I can define right and left by geography. Of course, the actual situation in any system doesn't have to have the symmetry that we're talking about. It's a question of whether the laws are symmetrical. In other words, whether it would be impossible, it's against the physical laws to have a sphere like the Earth with dirt and a guy like me standing, looking at a city like Chicago from a place like New Orleans, but everything the other way around, so that Chicago's on the other side. It's not impossible. I mean, Florida. It's not impossible against the physical laws, or at least that's what we're discussing, to have everything change left for right. Another thing is it shouldn't depend on history. But an easy way to distinguish right from left is to go down to the shop and to pick up a screw at random. The odds are it's got a right-hand thread. Not necessarily, but it more likely has a right-hand thread. This is a question of history or convention or the way things happen to be, and is not the question of the fundamental laws different. As you well appreciate, everybody could have started out making left-hand screws. Now we try to find another phenomenon in which right hand is involved fundamentally. And the next one we discuss is the fact that polarized light rotates its plane as it goes through, say, sugar water. As you remember, for instance, it rotates, let's say, to the right in some sugar. Well, that's a way of defining the right hand, because we dissolve the sugar in the water, and then the polarization goes to the right. The sugar has come from living things, however. And if you try to make the sugar artificially, then you discover, first, that it doesn't rotate the plane of polarization. Then you look more carefully at the sugar and do a whole lot of reactions. And if you're careful enough under certain circumstances, which I'll explain in a minute, which in fact, if you use living things, it helps a lot. For example, if you take that same sugar, which is made artificially, and which doesn't rotate the plane of polarization, and then you put bacteria in it, they eat sugar. And you take the filter the bacteria out, you find you still got sugar there, almost half as much as you had before, but you still got sugar there. And this time it rotates the plane of polarization, but the other way than the sugar does for real living things. Rather confusing, easily explained. Let's take another example. One of the substances which is common to all living creatures is very, very fundamental to life is the proteins. And the proteins consist of chains of amino acids. And I've got here a model of an amino acid that comes out of a protein right here, which is carbon atoms are black and hydrogen atoms are white and oxygen atoms are red and nitrogen is blue. Now, of course, in the model, just for your own interest, the real atoms are bigger. They fit together tighter than this. This is just easy to see this way. This substance is an amino acid called alanine, and it would look like this, the molecular arrangement, if it comes out of a protein of a real living thing. On the other hand, if we try to make alanine from carbon dioxide, methane, and ammonia, it's not a complicated molecule, we can make it, and we discover that we're making equal amounts of this molecule over here. This molecule that comes from the living thing is called L-alanine, capital L-alanine. And this one over here, which is the same chemically in as far, I mean the same arrangement, the same connections of the atoms, but a left-hand molecule for the right-hand one over there is called D-alanine. And the interesting thing is that when we make it at home in the laboratory and from simple gases, we get an equal mixture of both of these. However, the only thing that life uses is this one. It's not exactly true. In the proteins, this is here and there in the living creatures, there's a special use for this molecule, but it's very rare. The great majority of cases, it's this one. And in all the proteins, this is it, always. So if we just hydrolyze the proteins, we always get these. Now, if we make the both, and we put some animal in which likes to eat or use up alanine, it can't use that one, so it only uses this one. And so that one's left. And that's what happened to our sugar case. You see, the other kind is left after the bacteria eat the sugar. That works good for them. So it looks as though life, the phenomena of life, permit a distinction between the two. Or chemistry permits a distinction, because this is chemically different than that. No, it is not. As far as any energy, any physical measurements can be made, like energy or any other the chemical rates of reactions and so on, this and this go the same way. That is, if you make everything else in a mirror image. This will rotate light to the right. This will rotate it to the left in precisely the same amount. This rotates light to the right a certain amount, and this rotates light to the left, the corresponding amount through the same amount of fluid. So that as far as the physics is concerned, these two amino acids are equally satisfactory. And as far as the chemistry is concerned, they're equally satisfactory. And as far as we understand things today, the fundamentals of the Schrödinger equation have it that that molecule and that molecule should behave in corresponding ways, that one is to the right as the other is to the left. Nevertheless, in life, it's all one way. Now, it's presumed that the reason for this is the following. Well, let's suppose, for example, that life got somehow is at the moment in this condition at the way it is now. It's all on a certain side, as all the proteins and some creatures have all left-handed things. Then all the enzymes are lopsided. Every substance in the living creature is lopsided. It is not symmetrical. So when the enzymes come, which do the digestion, which change their chemical from one kind to another, this one fits into the enzyme, but this one doesn't fit into the enzyme. It's like the Cinderella in a slipper, except it's a left-hand foot that you're testing. So that it, as far as we know, it would be possible, in principle, we could, for example, build a frog in which every molecule is reversed. Every atom is twisted. I mean, everything is right to left of a real frog. We have a sort of a left-hand frog. And this left-hand frog would go on all right for a while, but he'd find nothing to eat because his enzymes are built. And if he swallows a fly, the fly's got the wrong kind of, unless we give him a left-hand fly, you see? So as far as we know, the chemical processes and the life processes would continue in the same manner if everything were reversed. But the fact that all the proteins and all the life, from the lowest to the highest, from everything to everything else, always have the same corkscrew is probably the most brilliant evidence for the correctness of the common evolution of all life. Because if the life is a physical phenomenon, a chemical phenomenon, then we can understand the fact that they're all from the corkscrew, same corkscrew, only from the idea that at the very beginning, some few molecules by accident got started, a few, one. Somewhere once, one carbon atom was lopsided a certain way, and from this particular thing is where the life happened to evolve, in that particular geography, that particular historical accident was left-hand, was one-sided. And ever since then, the one-sidedness propagates itself. Once gotten to the state that it's in now, of course, it will always continue. All the enzymes digest the right things, manufacture the right thing. When the carbon dioxide and the water vapor and so on go into plant leaves, why the enzymes that make the sugars make them lopsided, because the enzymes are lopsided. And so they pass the, there's no conservation of the number of right-handed molecules. You can increase, once you got started, you can keep increasing them. So the presumption is then that the phenomena in case of life do not show a lack of the symmetry in physical law, but do show, on the contrary, the universal nature and the commonness of the evolution of all the creatures. Now we go further. You say, now look, in the physics, there are a lot of other places where you got right and left-hand rules. As a matter of fact, when we learn about vector analysis, we go crazy with the right-hand rules in order to get the angular momentum and the torques and so on, and magnetic fields, and the force on a magnetic field, for example, is Q times V cross B, and then there are screamings about how you must take the velocity this way, the magnetic field this way, take a right hand. But isn't that enough to define a right hand? As a matter of fact, we know, if we look at it again, if we go back and look at where the vectors came from, that it was merely a convention, it was a trick, that the original things, the angular momenta and the angular velocities and things of this kind, were really not vectors. It was just because they were something on a surface, on a plane, and it was just because there were three dimensions that we could associate a direction perpendicular to that plane, and we chose the right-hand direction. So if the laws of physics are symmetrical, it should be this way, that if some demon were to sneak into all the physics laboratories and replace the word right for left in every book, where the right-hand rules are given, you use always the left-hand rules perpetually, that it should make no difference whatever in the physical laws. Let me give an illustration. There are two kinds of vectors then. There are honest vectors, which we call polar vectors. For example, a step in space. If in the apparatus there's a piece of thing here and there's something else here, then in the mirror apparatus there would be a piece of thing here and something there. And if we draw the vector from the piece of thing to the something, the vector is the mirror of the other one. The vector arrow changes head just as the whole space turns around. Such a vector we call a polar vector. But the other kind of a vector, which has to do with rotation, is of a different nature. For example, suppose that this is the three dimensions of axes, and something is rotating around this way, say. Then if we look at it in a mirror, it will be rotating this way, which is the mirror image of the rotation over here. Now, we represent a rotation that way by a vector in this direction here. And we represent a rotation this, no, we represent a rotation the same way it is, no, with a vector this way. So you see that this kind of a vector on a reflection does not change about as the polar vector does, but is relatively reversed relative to the polar vectors and to the geometry of the space. Such a vector is called an axial vector. Now, if the law of reflection symmetry is right in physics, then it must be true that the equations must be so designed that if you change the sign of all the axial vectors, which would be what corresponds to reflection, nothing will happen. So the laws must have this rule, that the equations are such that if you change the sign of all axial vectors, nothing happens. Incidentally, this should include the change of sign once for each cross product, because a cross product also has a signature in it. So for instance, when we write a formula that says the angular momentum is P cross R, that's okay, because if we change to a left-hand system, if we want to change the sign, the polar vectors P and R do not change. The cross product says change once. L, we know, is a polar vector, change once, so the equation would be maintained. And then all the other equations, too. From this, for example, that the force is equal to V cross B, if we change from a right to a left system, then the V must change. That means that B must be an axial vector. In other words, when we make such a reflection, B must go to minus B. So if we change something from right to left, we must also change the poles of magnets from north to south. The B also changes. Let's see how that works in an example. Suppose that I have built two magnets, which I'll draw here. Here's a magnet with the coils going around this way, and the current, not the electrons, but the current, going around this way. Now, here's another magnet in a mirror. It's this magnet in the mirror. So the coil will look like this, and everything that happens inside the, I don't know how to draw, well, I'm doing all right, actually. The same coil, exactly, it's a mirror image, and the current will go this way. Now, in the laws for the production of magnetic fields, which we don't know yet, but we have one that says that the magnetic field from a light wave is a unit vector in a direction of observation cross E. So that shows that it's going to be a cross product in the formula for the production of the magnetic field. And there are rules you must have learned in high school about right-hand rules here, so that it turns out that the magnetic field is this way, and that this pole here is a south magnetic pole, while here is going around the other way, and the magnetic field is reversed. It's a north magnetic pole. So you see that when we go from right to left, we must change north to south. But never mind changing north to south. Let's talk about phenomena. Suppose now that we have an electron moving through this field. It's coming up from going through this way. I have to draw the projection. Moving this way in the field, there's an electron. Then if you know the formula for the force V cross B, remember the charge is minus, you find that the electron actually has to, in this kind of a field, driven this way, will have to deviate in this direction according to the physical law. So the phenomenon is you've got a coil here with the current going this way, then an electron curves that way. That's the physics, never mind how you label everything, but that's what happens. Now let's do the same experiment in a mirror. We send an electron in the corresponding direction. Now the forces are reversed because, well, the force comes out in this direction if you figure it out from the same rule. And that's very good because the corresponding motions are mirror images. So the fact of the matter is that in studying any complete phenomena, there are always two right-hand rules, or even number of them, and the net result is that the phenomena look symmetrical. In short, therefore, we cannot tell right from left if we also are not able to tell north from south. However, we can tell the north pole of a magnet. The compass needle, for example, is the one that points to the north. But that's a local business. That's got to do with the geography of the Earth. That's just like talking about which direction is Chicago. So that doesn't count. You say, yeah, I've seen compass needles, or the north-seeking pole is a sort of a bluish color. But that's just the guy who made the magnet painting it. In other words, if a magnet would have a property that on the north pole, if you looked at it close enough, you'd see small hairs growing, but not on the south pole. If that were a general rule, then that would be the end of the principle of reflection symmetry. If there was some unique way to tell the north and south pole of a magnet, then you could tell which of the two cases you had, and that would be the end of the law of reflection symmetry. To illustrate still more clearly the whole problem, I would like you to imagine that we were talking to a Martian or someone very far away by telephone. You're not allowed to send them any samples. For instance, if you say you do it by light, you could send them right circularly polarized light and say, that I mean is that's right. See, you watch which way it's polarized. You don't give them anything. You just give them information. You talk to them. And he is so far away or in some strange location that he can't see anything that you can see. For instance, you can't say, look at Ursa Major. Now, you see how those stars are arranged? Well, what I mean by right is, and so forth. No? But you're only allowed to telephone them, and you want to tell them all about us. Of course, first you start defining numbers, and you say tick, tick, two, tick, 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 three, and so gradually you can understand a couple of words and so on. And then you begin to get, after a while, you get very familiar with this fellow, and pretty soon he says, what do you guys look like? So you start out, you say, well, we're 6 feet tall. He says, wait a minute, what's 6 feet? Is it possible to tell him what 6 feet is? Certainly. We say, you know how you take hydrogen atoms, and you know the diameter, 9 billion hydrogen atoms high. So you make 9 billion hydrogen atoms high, that's definite. And that's because change of scale is not something under which the physical laws are invariant, and therefore we can define absolute length. So after defining the size, and we tell them what the general shape is, it's got prongs with five bumps sticking out in the ends of the hands, and so on, and everything's going along, and when you're all finished describing how it looks from the outside, from which you have presumably no particular difficulties in ultimately describing, he's making a model as you go along, you see, and he says, wow, you're very handsome fellows. He said, now what's on the inside? So you start to describe the various organs on the inside, and you come to the heart, say, and describe the shape of it and all. Say, now put the heart on the left side. He says, the left side. Now your problem is to describe to him which side to put the heart without him ever seeing anything that you see, or without you ever sending any sample to him of what you mean by right. No standard right-handed object. You can't figure it out. And it turns out that the laws of gravitation, the laws of electricity and magnetism, nuclear forces are all okay. They all satisfy the principle of reflection symmetry. But then it turned out, gradually, in the new particles that were found, there's a very weak, in all particles, there's a phenomenon called beta decay or weak decay. And one of the examples of weak decay was a particle was discovered, let's say about 1956, the following was a puzzle. There was a certain particle which disintegrated into 3-pi meson. As a matter of fact, the first slide shows it's better than a drawing. Here we see a track coming in, and this object was disintegrating into 3-pi mesons. This was called for a while a tau meson. It disintegrates into 3-pi meson. Now on the next slide, we show another particle which disintegrates into 2 mesons. And this was called a theta. Here it has bounced back from the plate and is disintegrating into 2 mesons. The other one must be neutral from the conservation of charge, but you can figure out where it is from the conservation of momentum and show it's got the mass of a meson. So here we have a particle called a tau, which disintegrates into 3 mesons, 3-pi mesons, and the theta, which disintegrates into 2-pi meson. Okay. Thanks for the lights, please. Now, the first thing that was discovered was that the mass of the theta and the tau were almost equal. In fact, within the experimental error, they were equal. Next, the length of time it took for them to disintegrate into 3-pi's and 2-pi's were almost exactly the same. They lived the same length of time. Next, whenever they were made in the same proportions. You always found 14%. I don't know the numbers now. I'm sorry. Say 14% tau's to the 86% theta. No matter what angle you produced them. Anybody in his right mind realizes immediately that they're the same particle, that you produce an object which has two different ways that it can disintegrate, not two different particles. This object that you can disintegrate in the two different ways has therefore the same lifetime, the same production ratio, because this is a ratio of the odds into which it disintegrates into these two kinds. However, it was possible to prove, and I can't explain at all why, that by the principle of reflection symmetry in the quantum mechanics, that it was impossible to have these both come from the same particle. The same particle couldn't disintegrate into both of these. According to the principle of reflection symmetry, the corresponding conservation law is something that has no classical analog and was called the conservation of parity. So it was a rule by the conservation of parity, or more precisely, from the symmetry under reflection, that the same particle couldn't go into both, so it must be some kind of coincidence of masses and so on. But the more it was studied, the more remarkable the coincidence, and the suspicion gradually grew that possibly the deep law of the reflection symmetry in nature may be false. And so Li and Yang suggested that other experiments be done in related phenomena, related decays, to try to demonstrate that the law, whether the law was correct in other cases of reflection symmetry. In the first experiment, one, he suggested a few, and the first one that was done by Ms. Wu from Columbia, and was done as follows. Taking a very strong magnet of this kind, and a very low temperature, it turns out that cobalt, which disintegrates by emitting an electron, is magnetic, has a little tiny magnet, and at the temperatures low enough that the thermal oscillations don't jiggle the magnet away too much, they line up in the magnetic field. So the cobalt atoms will all line up in this field. Then they disintegrate, emitting an electron. And it was discovered by Ms. Wu that most of the, when it was lined up in a field like this, say if this is the direction of the magnetic field, that most of the electrons were emitted in a downward direction. If you're not really hep to the world, such a remark doesn't sound like anything of any significance. But if you appreciate the problems and the interesting things in the world, then you see that this is a most dramatic discovery. That when you put cobalt atoms in an extremely strong magnetic field, more electrons go down in the disintegration than up. And therefore, that if you were to put it in the corresponding experiment in the mirror, in which the cobalt atoms would be lined up in the opposite direction, they would spit their electrons this way, not this way. And this is unsymmetrical. The magnet has grown hairs. The north pole of a magnet, the south pole of a magnet is of such a kind that the electrons in a disintegration when the cobalt is near it tend to go away from it. That distinguishes in a physical way the south pole from the north pole. Well, immediately on this point, a lot of other experiments were done. The disintegration of the pi into mu and nu, mu into electron and two neutrinos. Nowadays, the lambda into proton and pi. Disintegration to sigmas, many of the disintegrations. In fact, almost all where it could be expected now have been found not to obey reflection symmetry, and that fundamentally the law of reflection symmetry at this level in physics is incorrect. In short, we can tell a Martian where to put the heart. We say, listen, build yourself a magnet, see, and put the coils in and turn the current on, and then take some cobalt and lower the temperature. Then I'm not going to chase all the signs through, but it's going to go something like this. Arrange the thing so that the electrons go from the foot to the head. I'm not going to check my signs with this. Then the direction in which the coils are is the direction that goes in on the what I call the right and comes out on the left, the way the current is going around in the magnet. And that defines the left. So it's possible to define right and left. Now, by using an experiment of this kind, there are a lot of other features that were predicted. For example, it turns out that the spin, the angular momentum of the cobalt nucleus before disintegration is 5 and after disintegration is 4. And the electron carries this angular momentum out. And so there's also a neutrino involved. But it's easy to see from this that the electron must carry its angular momentum this way, the neutrino likewise. And so it looks like the electron is spinning to the left. And that was also checked. In fact, that was checked here at Caltech by Berman and Wattstra, that the electrons spin mostly to the left. There were some experiments that gave the opposite answer, but they were wrong. The next question, of course, was the law of the failure. What is the rule that tells us how strong the failure is going to be? And the rule is this. It only occurs in these very slow reactions called weak decays. And when it occurs, the rule is that the particles which carry spin, like the electron, neutrino, and so on, will come out with a spin tending to the left as they go along. That is, as the particle is emitted, it spins to the left from a beta decay. The electron, when it's emitted, spins to the left. That is a lopsided rule. It connects a velocity and an angular momentum. And as a relation, it says that the angular momentum is more likely proportional to the velocity than not. And that's V is proportional to L, and that's a polar vector and an axial vector. Well, it's obvious that it's not got a left and right symmetry. Now, that is the rule, but today we really do not understand the whys and wherefores of it. Why is this the right rule? I mean, what's the fundamental reason for the whole business and so on, and how is it connected to anything else? At the moment, we've been so kind of shocked by the fact that this thing is unsymmetrical that we have not been able to recover far enough to understand what it means with regard to all the other rules. However, the subject is interesting enough, modern enough, and unsolved that I thought you'd like to hear some of the questions that are associated with it. The first question immediately when one of the symmetries is lost is to go back over the list and ask whether any of the others are lost. Now, I didn't mention one, which I would like to mention now, which, in which on the list must necessarily be questioned. And that is the question, the relation of between matter and antimatter. It became apparent, at first Dirac predicted, that that although we have electrons, that there must be another particle, which is called the positron, discovered here by Anderson, that is necessarily related to the electron, in the sense the masses are equal, the charges happen to be reversed, all the properties are correspond in a way, like, but there are certain rules of correspondence, like the energies are equal, the masses are equal, the charges are reversed. But more important than anything, that the two of them, when they come together, can annihilate, liberating everything in just in the form of energy, say gamma rays. That's the characteristic of an antiparticle. This is called an antiparticle to the electron. It was clear from Dirac's argument that all the rest of the particles should have corresponding a lot of the other particles should have their correspondence. For instance, with the proton, there should be an antiproton, which is now symbolized with a P with a bar over it. The P bar would have a negative electrical charge, but have the same mass as a proton, and so on. Most important feature, however, is that a proton and an antiproton coming together could annihilate each other. The reason I emphasize that is because people don't understand it when you say you have a neutron and there's also an antineutron. Because they say a neutron is neutral, so how could it have the opposite charge? The rule of anti isn't that it has just the opposite charge. It has a certain set of properties which are opposite, a whole set. And the antineutron is distinguished from the neutron this way. If I bring two neutrons together, they just say two neutrons. But if I bring a neutron and an antineutron together, they annihilate each other with a great explosion, energy being liberated, various pi mesons and whatnot. Otherwise, they have the same mass and so on. So these are antiparticles. Now, if we have antineutrons, antiprotons, and antielectrons, we can make antiatoms in principle. It's not been made yet, but it's possible in principle. For instance, a hydrogen atom is a proton in the center with an electron outside going around. Now, imagine that somewhere we could make an antiproton with a positron going around. Would it go around? Well, first of all, the antiproton is electrically negative and the antielectron is electrically positive, so they attract each other in a corresponding manner. Masses are all the same, everything all the same. And it was one of the principles of symmetry of physics. The equation seemed to show that if a thing were made out of matter over here, and then you made the same clock out of antimatter, precisely, then it would run the same way. That matter and antimatter would behave, the spectrum would look the same, everything would be the same. Of course, not when you compare one to the other. If you two put a piece of matter and put the clocks together, then they all annihilate each other, but that's different. Now, an immediate question, then, is this. Matter and antimatter are supposed to be the same. I can now build, however, out of matter, two clocks, one which is left-hand and one which is right-hand. For example, I could build a clock which is not built in a simple way, but it has magnets and stuff in it and electric detectors which detect the presence of the electrons and count them, and each time it counts them, it moves the second hand over. Then the mirror clock, having less electrons, will not run at the same rate. So you see, I can make two clocks so that the left-hand clock doesn't agree with the right. Now, there's a problem. I make out of matter a clock, which I call the standard or right-handed clock. Now I make out of matter a clock, which I call a left-hand clock. We have just discovered that in general, those two will not run the same way. Previous to that physical discovery, it was thought that they would. Now, it was also supposed that matter and antimatter are equivalent. That is, if I made an antimatter clock, right hand, same shape, but made out of antimatter, that it would run the same as this. And if I made the same clock to the left, it would run the same. In other words, in the beginning, it was believed that all four of these are the same. Now we know that the matter and antimatter are no longer the same. And presumably, therefore, the right-handed antimatter and the left-handed antimatter are not the same. So the obvious question is, which one goes with which, if either? In other words, does the right-handed matter behave the same way as the right-handed antimatter, or does it behave the same way as the left-handed antimatter? Well, the experiments from the beta decay indicate, using positron decays instead of electron decays, that this is the interconnection. Matter to the right works the same way as antimatter to the left. And therefore, at long last, it is really true that right and left symmetry is still maintained. What's the combination, you see? That if you made a clock left hand from the other, but made out of the other kind of matter, antimatter instead of matter, then it would run the same way. So that what has happened is that instead of having two independent rules in our list of symmetries, these two go together to make a new rule, which is matter to the right and antimatter to the left are symmetrical, but not the other way around. So that if our Martian is made out of antimatter, and we give him the instructions to make this right-handed model and make the model like us and so on, it will, of course, come out the other way around. And of course, what would happen would be that after much conversation back and forth, we each teach each other how to make spaceships. We meet halfway in empty space, and the two guys, we've instructed each other on our traditions and so on, and the two guys come rushing out, and he comes marching, running out to shake your hand, a great greeting. Well, if he puts out his left hand, watch out. Now, the next question is what to make out of laws which are nearly symmetrical. You see, the marvelous thing about it all is that such a wide range of important, strong phenomena, nuclear forces, electrical phenomena, even weak ones like gravitation, but over a tremendous range of physics, all the laws seem to be symmetrical. On the other hand, this little extra piece says, no, they're not. The law, general principle is they're not symmetrical. How is it nature can be almost symmetrical and not perfectly symmetrical? What shall we make of this? First, do we have any other examples of things which are nearly symmetrical but not quite? And the answer is we do, in fact, have a few other examples. For example, the nuclear part of the force between proton and proton, between neutron and neutron, and neutron and proton are exactly the same. There's a symmetry for nuclear forces, a new one, that you can interchange neutron and proton. But it evidently is not a general symmetry. For the electrical interaction between two protons at a distance, the repulsion, doesn't exist for neutrons. So it's not generally true. You can always replace a proton with a neutron. But to a good approximation. Why good? Because the nuclear force is so much stronger than the electrical forces. So it's an almost symmetry also. So we do have examples of the other thing. We have in our mind a tendency to accept symmetry as some kind of perfection. In fact, it's like the old idea of the Greeks that circles were perfect. And it was rather horrible to believe that the orbits weren't circles, they were nearly circles. In order for something to, the difference between being a circle and being nearly a circle is not a small difference. It's a fundamental change as far as the mind is concerned, because there's a sign of perfection and symmetry in a circle that isn't there the moment it's slightly off. That's the end of it. It's no longer symmetric. Then the question is, why is it nearly a circle? A much more difficult question. The actual motion of the planets in general should be complicated, or rather elliptical, ellipses, very elliptical. But during the ages, due to tidal forces and so on, it made things almost symmetrical. Now the question is whether we have a similar problem here. The problem, you see, from the point of view of the circles is if they were perfect circles, there's nothing to explain because that's clearly simple. But if they're only nearly circles, there's a lot to explain, and the result turned out to be a big dynamical problem. And now our problem is to explain why they're nearly symmetrical by looking at tidal forces and so on. So our problem really is to explain where the symmetry comes from. Why nature is so nearly symmetric? Put it the other way, instead of saying why is she slightly anti-symmetric, say why is she nearly symmetric? Because it isn't absolutely symmetric, but it's nearly so. The question is why is it nearly so? Nobody has any idea. The only thing I might suggest is something that an interesting point, there's a gate in Japan, a gate in Nikko, which is sometimes called by the Japanese the most beautiful gate in all Japan. But it was built in a time when there was great influence from the Chinese art. It's the Yomeiman Gate, it's called. And it's a very elaborate thing with lots of gables and very elaborate and beautiful carving all over and lots of columns. It has dragon heads here and dragon heads there. It's a beautiful thing, marvelous gate with figures of princes carved into the pillars and so on. But then, when you look closer, you'll see that in the elaborate and complex design along one of the pillars, one of the design elements, one of the small design elements, is carved upside down on one of the pillars. There otherwise, the thing is completely symmetrical, left and right, but this one thing is turned upside down. And if you ask why is this, Then the story is this. It's carved upside down so that the gods will not be jealous of the perfection of man, that man is so perfect. So they put a purposely an error in there so that the gods will not be jealous and get angry at human beings. So I'd like to turn the idea around and claim that the true explanation of the near symmetry is this, that God made the laws only nearly symmetrical so that we shouldn't be jealous of his perfection. Thank you. That's a good idea.
Forgot about next year.
Yeah, next year. I'll see you next year.
Are you teaching us? Are you lecturing the sophomore next year?
Yes, sir. It's been decided. Well, do a good job on the exam and have a good vacation. I'll see you next year.
If you don't
do a good job, I won't see you next year.
Dr. Feinman, yeah. A New Yorker a few weeks ago said that you suggested this idea or implied something like that about this non-conservation of parents.
Well, I haven't seen the article, but... that's right, yes, it was in Rochester. I had a roommate whose name was Block, Martin Block. And the night before, he said to me, listen, Feynman, this business, they called it the Tau Theta puzzle. They'd been discussing it before a lot of times. And he said to me, you know, he said, I think that the easiest explanation is that those two are part of the same particle. He says, how good is this damn law of yours, the so-called parity rule? Why, what is it based? So I explained to him that would mean that right and left was not equivalent, and you could define right hands. And I said that I thought that it wasn't absolutely impossible, that as a matter of fact, by this time, the evidence had accumulated very seriously. And so he said, well, next time in the meeting, why don't you bring up that possibility? I says, you bring it up, and you thought of it. He says, no, they won't listen to me. They'll only listen to you. So at the next meeting, at the next day, I came in, and Oppenheimer said, you can find it. It's quite interesting, because they have a record of all the words. And Oppenheimer said, well, this puzzle, after a lot of discussion of the puzzle, this is sufficiently difficult that we ought to open our minds and think of some crazy ideas. So I thought that's the right time. So I got up and I said that I'm asking this question for Mr. Martin Block. See? And then I asked the question why it couldn't be from different people. Does anybody have any idea? And then I got some kind of answer from Lee that I didn't understand. And Oppenheimer said, I guess it's time to close our minds again. In other words, this is such a crazy idea. But people kidded me after that. They said, what's the matter? You're yellow? You bring it up and you say, I'm asking this idea for Martin Block. The real reason is I believed it was possible. See, it was very, nobody believed it. It's such a deep thing, you wouldn't believe it. So I believed it was possible, and I thought that someday the credit ought to go to him as being the first guy to propose it seriously. And so when I said, I'm asking this for Martin Block, I was trying to get the credits in the right place. And everybody teased me and said I was only doing that because I was just scared to ask for myself. But that was the first time that it was publicly suggested in a serious way. And then Li and Yang took it even more seriously and proposed the various experiments to try, two among others, in which were tried by one by Wu that I described, and another one by Goldwyn or something, I forget.
And then they turned it into a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they really, you see that, it shows that one must, yes it is, but one must follow an idea far enough to make it useful rather than just mumble it. I also had something to do with finding out the rule that all the particles come out left is the general rule as a theoretical rule before the experiments were consistent with each other. Me and Gell-Mann did that. Okay.